share with him in his experiences and strengthen this program. Anything that I could say... is the mic dead? Huh? Well, if the mic's dead, I'm dead. About the only thing that I would like to say is, from purely a personal opinion, this has been one of the most wonderful gatherings that I have ever attended. And the fitting climax to it, we'll be able to share in this morning. Anything that I could say about the speaker, you already know. So it's with love and a great deal of gratitude I introduce Chuck C., Laguna Beach, California.
Thank you, Harold. I am Chuck C., and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Thank you. You know, the committee got exercised yesterday about my voice. And so they got to ask me if I needed a doctor. I didn't think I did, because I knew how many of you were praying for me. And I thank you for that. But we got an AA doctor, and he went out personally and bought me some stuff and brought it to the room. And he didn't charge anything for it. And then they got a little more concerned. So they thought we ought to have a specialist. So we went to a specialist and took the stuff the AA doctor had given me. And he says, well, this is fine. This is fine. Do it like this. And he charges us $15. So I think I'm going to be able to get through all right. I hope I will. With God's help. You know, all the AA speakers, but Eve and I, we're bald-headed. This is rather unusual. Because we don't have nearly the incidence of bald heads in the AA society that they do in any other society in the country. Enough so that medical men have sort of studied to see if this had any bearing on drinking. But it sort of tickles me because some of them tried to establish the fact that this was because they were more spiritual. Ha ha! Now I'll tell you the truth about that. If you're bald back here, it's a sign you're sexy. If you're bald up here, it's a sign you're a thinker. And if you're bald all the way across like they are, it's a sign you think you're sexy. You know, the theme of this conference has been love and service. Love and service, or gratitude and service, which would be pretty much the same thing. And I think it's been one of the most beautiful conferences that I've ever attended. Every speaker has been tops. They've all done beautifully. And all of them were pretty much on the theme. But this is the first convention or conference I ever attended where it struck me that if the chairman and the speakers had been reversed, you'd have had just as good a conference as you have had. Every one of these chairmen are as good up here as anybody that's appeared. And so I wasn't too much concerned from the beginning, because I could have well sat here and listened to Harold. I don't think he would have given my talk. Breen does that. If he hadn't had to leave, I'd prod him a little bit more about it, but he had to go, so I let him up. We might say to ourselves, who's liable to be an alcoholic? Is alcoholism any respect of persons? And of course, we'd have to say no. My barber is an alcoholic, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My attorney is an alcoholic, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My doctor is an alcoholic, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my banker is an alcoholic, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My dentist's wife died an alcoholic without coming to the program. And my CPA's wife died an alcoholic without coming to the program. So you see, alcoholism is no respecter of persons. Anybody might be an alcoholic. And then we might say to ourselves, well, does alcohol alone cause alcoholism? And I think we'd have to say no. Because if alcohol alone caused alcoholism, every excessive drinker would be an alcoholic. And this is not the case. This is not the case. There are literally millions of good old Saturday night drunks that aren't alcoholics at all. I have drunk with men who could get just as drunk as I did, and who did things that I never did, like coming home and cleaning house. Tossing the furniture through the window and their wife on top of it. I never did that. I never struck my wife or my kids in my life. I don't know why, they sure as hell needed it on many occasions. But I've known men that could do that and get up in the morning and shake their heads and say, uh-oh, got drunk last night, didn't I? And they never get any worse and they never get any better. They are not alcoholics. They're just good old Saturday night drunks. They tell us that less than 6% of those who live on the skid rows of our country
are alcoholics, isn't it, them?
Because usually the general public, the non-alcoholic world, the earth people, think that alcoholism is confined to the skid row bum. And this is not true. So we'd have to say that alcohol alone doesn't cause alcoholism. I think we'd have to conclude that alcohol plus a spiritual, mental, and physical combination that's ripe for it causes alcoholism. I think that there are only a few things that can happen to people like us, alcoholics. From the very day that we're born, there's just a few things that might happen to us. Either we're going to be priests, or preachers, or nuns, or alcoholics, or hopheads. That's all that's going to happen to us. Because you take people like us and turn us loose in this world, and we've got to have an answer before we can live. And it isn't because we want to be different. We're not rebels because we want to be. If there were ever a bunch of people on earth who would like so much to be a part of, and who are forever apart from, it's the alcoholics of the land. And it's not by choice that we are rebels. I can look over 25 years. Let's start over. I can look over 21 years and 6 months of sobriety in this program. 25 years of drinking, and the time before that. And I can see that from the very beginning of my life, I was a misfit. And it wasn't by choice. Now I have 3 sisters and 2 brothers. And I'm the only alcoholic in the bunch. We ate the same things. We had the same mother and presumably the same dad. We went to the same school. We went to the same church. And yet I'm an alcoholic, and none of the rest of them are. And I think this is very meaningful. The second time that I had gone to New York as a delegate from the Southern California area, my second year, Mrs. T and I visited all 5 of these sisters and brothers on our way back to California. And we got back, and we were sitting talking about the trip, and I said to my wife, honey, isn't it wonderful that all these kids are doing so well? None of them are in want. They all have their lives, and they're pretty good. And they're all reasonably happy. Isn't it fine that they're doing so well? But, said I, if I had to live like any one of them, I'd rather be drunk. Now, I would amend that now. I wouldn't say I'd rather be drunk, because I'd rather be dead than drunk. But I couldn't live like that, and that's the reason I'm an alcoholic. I could not live like that. And it's because of the combination of characteristics with which we arrived in this world. It's not our fault, in my opinion. I often say at the end of a talk, we have to come to the point where we can and do say, if there be fault, it's mine. If there be fault, it is mine. And I say, if there be fault, because I do not believe there's fault. I think that it's simply because of our peculiar combination of characteristics. Now, I am convinced completely and beyond any shadow of a doubt that the first two words of the little prayer that we'll end this meeting with mean exactly what they say. Exactly what they say. Our Father. Our Father. You remember when they asked carpenters? They said, Master, teach us to pray. He said, after this manner, pray ye, our Father. His Father, your Father, and mine. Because you see, if God is our Father, we're his kids. And it has to be. It can't be any other way. If God is our Father, we're his kids. We are all his kids. Even the non-alcoholics is too good for you, but that's true about you too. Now, as God's kids, all of us have these characteristics that I'm going to mention. We don't have an exclusive on them. We only have an exclusive on the combination. For instance, I don't know if there's anybody in the country that has met more alcoholics than I have or not. Maybe there are, but I rather doubt it. But every alcoholic I've ever known, regardless of race, creed, or color, regardless of educational background, good or bad, regardless of environment, every one of us are born perfectionists, idealists, with that terrific drive for excellence from the very beginning. Now, there is nothing wrong with perfectionism after you and I learn to live with it. But before we learn to live with it, it is a killer. Because it makes us demand more of ourselves than we can put out. But worse than that, it makes us demand more of the world, more of the people around us, than they can put out. And it makes it impossible for us to settle for what we see. We simply cannot integrate ourselves into life because we don't like it. It is not according to our pattern. That's number one. Number two, every one of us were born with the interior awareness that life is a good and a big and a beautiful thing. It came with it. I have always known that life should be what it is today for me. I've always known. I was born knowing that this is the kind of life that we should have. But I couldn't find it. And this is one of our great problems. This is one of our great problems. Because in here it says life is big and beautiful and good. And out there, it's cheap and it's dirty and it's ugly. And we're trapped. And lastly, and this is the most incongruous thing you'll ever hear come out of the mouth of anybody, Don't tell this to the non-alcoholic world. We are a highly sensitive people. Now, isn't that awful? Highly sensitive people. And the way they see us, there we lay in the gutter, you know. And the pig got up and slowly walked away. And yet we are a highly sensitive people. And everything in life hurts us. Going clear back to my furthest memory. Life hurt me. My own father and my own mother hurt me when they did things that were less than perfect. It hurt me. And at a very young age, I started building a wall to keep from getting hurt. Now, I think this sensitivity of ours is the reason that the psychiatrists of the world have labeled us as emotionally immature. I don't believe it. I cry just as easy now as I ever did. And I laugh much easier. And I don't think it's emotional immaturity. I think it's 5 or 10 times the capacity for feeling that the so-called normal world has. I have stood in front of 300 or 400 men in Folsom Prison in California. Now Folsom is where they take the bad boys. You can't even get in there for murder if it's the first time. You gotta be a 4-time loser to get in there. The boys up there tell me that the swallows that build in those walls formerly went to Capistrano. But they're 4-time losers. And so they're supposed to be tough, habitual criminals. And I stood there and watched every one of them bawl right along with me and let the tears bounce off of their bellies. And it wasn't because they were emotionally immature. It was because of the great identity. They felt in here just exactly like I did. And we laughed and we cried together. So it isn't emotional immaturity, it's a great sensitivity. And the capacity for feeling that is not what you might call normal. Now you see, all these characteristics are beautiful. There's nothing wrong with these things. After we learn to live with them. But before we learn to live with them, they make it impossible for us to integrate ourselves into society. And when you and I find liquor, I never had a drink until I was through school. I was an athlete. And I was always in training. And I never smoked and I never drank until I was out of school. So I was as big as I am now. Before I ever had a drink. And yet when I took my first slug, just as every one of the speakers in this conference have said, it did something for me that was wonderful. It was an answer for me. It was not a problem. Now, this should say something to those who are trying to study alcoholism. Because, you see, if I hadn't needed an answer, alcohol would not have been an answer. The problem was already here before I ever took that first plug. And the problem was me and my inability to integrate myself into the life around me. And I used alcohol as an answer for 15 years. And I didn't get into too much trouble in the first 15 years. I got drunk, but I got drunk on purpose. I got drunk when I wanted to, and when I didn't want to, I didn't. That's the only reason I ever drank the stuff. And I'm very fortunate in this, because I never used alcohol for anything else but to get drunk. I think if you wanted a primary alcoholic, whatever the hell that means, Breen was talking about it, you know. He don't know what it means. I've taught him everything he knows, and I don't know. The primary alcoholic, I guess, is the one that uses it that way. And the others are those who get caught because they have used this for other purposes. I think maybe that this is one of the things that makes women alcoholics a little bit more complicated than us men. Because many of them use it in order to do things that they can't do without it. Like having illicit love affairs and stuff like that, you know. And some of us, I've heard many of our people, the males, I mean, say that they used it to soften up a blonde or to help them in business deals and stuff like that. I never did. I never had any side effects. I just drank it to get drunk. And as a matter of fact, it was always sort of a thief as far as other things are concerned in my life. I think sometimes we guys think that drinking has something to do with virility. You got to drink like a man, whatever the hell that is. Drink like a man. It has something to do with virility. I'll tell you what it had to do with my virility. Way back in the early days, when I was drinking for fun, when the squares, the non-alcoholics, were out in the living room necking the beautiful women, where was I? I was in the bathroom. I had organized a male quartet. And we were singing Sweet Adelaide. So right from the beginning, it was a robber. But I didn't get into too bad trouble in the first 15 years. I had a code for drinking, just like I had for everything else. And I drank according to my own code. But after 15 years, something had happened. And I found that I was not drinking according to my code. And I looked at myself, and I diagnosed this as personal weakness. And alkies don't like weakness. I think this is the thing we hate worst in ourselves and those around us, is personal weakness. And so I figured I had to beat this deal. Now, I didn't think total abstinence was the answer. It never occurred to me that total abstinence was it. Any weakling could quit drinking. But it took a pretty good man to meet this thing head on and beat it. And so I started working on my problem. 10 years before I came to this program. And I worked on it diligently for 10 years. And the harder I worked, the worse it got. And the worse it got, the harder I worked. And I'm sure in the last 5 years that I drank, 90% of my waking time was spent on the problem. I became an alcoholic, a periodic, 10 years before coming to the program. Because of the fight. You see, I was going to beat this deal. And you can't fight a very good battle when you're down on your back. So I would have to get sober in order to get back in the ring for the next round. And I did everything that any man can do. I gave it everything I had, the battle. I gave it my wife, our kids, our home, my job, my health, my sanity, and my money. And if I'd have had anything else, I'd have put that in. But that's all I had. And I lost. I lost. Now the thing again that's so difficult for the non-alcoholic world to see. You see, I was physically as sober as I am this morning between every two drunks for 10 years. Physically as sober as I am right now between every two drunks for 10 years. And this was not good drinking. There is no alcoholic, male or female, that enjoys the life we have to live after we become compulsive drinkers. We hate that life worse than anybody in the world because, again, of our inside. That life is just as foreign to our inside as night is different from day. And here I was, able to look at it physically sober between every two drunks for 10 years. Now, I never had one period in that whole last 10 years where I could get there. Where everything was all right with me and you and God was in his heaven and all was well with the world. I never made it once in 10 years. And yet I went back and back and back and back and back and back, crying. Now, I think there were two reasons for that. Number one, I had always equated surrender with weakness. The weak man surrenders. The strong man wins his battle. And I could not surrender. I had to win. And secondly, and maybe this should be first, the only peace I had ever known in my entire lifetime before I found my peace in Alcoholics Anonymous was when I could get just right with that slip. That's the only peace I ever knew. And the farther backwards I went, the more vividly I could remember those little periods of peace and the more necessary it was to try to get there, try to get back. And for those two reasons, I beat my brains out. Now, everything happened in that last 10 years that happened to alcoholics. There was the drunks and the shakes and the sweats and the freezes. And the living long periods of time when you didn't know what months you were living in. And when you didn't know the real from the unreal. And the jails. And here's something that's interesting. You know, I never did get to the place where I was comfortable in jail. I just plumb don't like it in jail. And I think my family thought I loved it because I was down there so often. Then a little later on, the music with no visible means of support. Nearly all of you have heard this, but I got to tell you again. The first time I ever got to music, you know, I guess it was about 7 years before I got the program. And I was coming off a bad one. And I'd gone to the kitchen to get a glass of buttermilk and the tea kettle was sitting on the stove and the steam was coming out of the darn thing. And along with that steam came the most beautiful symphony I ever heard in my life. It was fabulous. And I stood there and enjoyed it for a little bit. And I thought to myself, this is the greatest phenomenon of modern times. This old tea kettle has become a receiving set. And so I went out and got the family and herded them in. To listen to the music. And of course they couldn't hear it. And I thought they were nuts. Well, I lived to hear a dozen bands at once. All of them with different announcers. Chopping away, you know. And a lot of it all for good music. But you couldn't turn it off. And it came out of peculiar places. It'd come out of the shower. Come out of the light. It'd come out of the toilet. But lots of it was good music. And then a little later on, the DTs, the screaming memes, and the alcoholic convulsions. Now you would think that anybody that could look at a record like that, physically sober, would not go through it again. But I did it for 10 long years. Because I had to win. It's the kind of people we are. And that's the reason we can't talk without talking a little bit about the nature of the problem. You know, I never knew until I'd burned up completely and run out of everything, including choice. I never knew what was the matter with me. I never knew why I couldn't drink like other people. Until I'd burned up and came to my first AA meeting. And people just like you told me, the very first night. And it's a wonderful thing to know. It's a wonderful thing to know. I think that there are only two classes of people who can fulfill the conditions for sobriety. Either we have to come to see that there's nothing ahead of us but permanent insanity or an alcoholic death. Or we have to drink the last dregs out of the bottom of the cup. One or the other. Because otherwise we cannot do the things that are necessary to obtain and maintain sobriety. And to come to see the nature of the problem without having to drink the last dregs out of the bottom of the cup. This is the wonder. This is the wonder of our program. This is the reason now the average age in Alcoholics Anonymous is dropping, dropping, dropping. We have in Southern California a group of young people that absolutely curl my hair. They're fabulous. They have their own inner group. Now, they're not a part from, they're part of. But they have their own inner group, and they have their own conferences and everything else. They also are members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they don't forget it. But they are fabulous. And they just, I love them to death. They're doing a terrific job. And so, for this reason, we talk a little about the nature of the problem. Now, why can't I successfully drink liquor? Because I'm an alcoholic. What is an alcoholic? An alcoholic is a person who suffers with the disease of alcoholism. The disease of alcoholism. I never heard that in my life until I got to my first meeting. And I've been to doctors, to men of the cloth, and the people that knew more psychiatry than there is. In my day, they didn't know the nature of my problem. Thank God. Many of them know it now. They've made it their business. And many non-alcoholics know the nature of our problem because they've made it their business to find out. And they can tell us and tell us where we can go to for an answer. But in my day, this was not true. All in the world they talked to me about was backbone, willpower, and stand up and be a man. And I didn't think I was deficient in those departments. And so they couldn't help me. And I didn't know the nature of my problem, couldn't help myself. The disease of alcoholism. Now, I've remained to find that informed medical opinion classify alcoholism as the third worst killer in the country today. Topped only by heart and cancer. Second only to one of our social diseases, a cause for permanent insanity. And medically speaking, it's incurable. And that's what I got. It's a matter of life or death, and it is my life. Very serious thing. Now, many medical men have told me, both in this country and in Canada, in the last dozen years, that if the brain explosions and heart failures that should be attributed to alcoholism were, presently, alcoholism would be by far number one as a killer. Now, they define the disease as a disease of a twofold nature, an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. An allergy of the body, physical, coupled with an obsession of the mind, mental. The reason I can't drink like those monkeys that kept saying to me, Chuck, you can't drink, you gotta quit, is because I am different physically and mentally, and it's an awful good thing to know. This is one of the things that destroyed me. 99% of the time that the guy was saying to me, Chuck, you can't drink, you gotta quit, I could look at him and he was obviously my inferior. He had neither my body nor my brain. Because, you see, I was smart, too. I was almost a genius. I have come to see in recent years that if I'd have been 2% smarter, I'd have died drunk. I am different, both physically and mentally, than the so-called normal drinker. Now, the allergy of the body means simply this, that my body, for some reason unknown to medical science, after 40 years of research, my body cannot successfully handle alcohol. I take one slug of liquor, I retain it, it goes into the bloodstream into the brain, and it triggers a physical demand that makes me keep on drinking until my cycle is run. This is not true with 90% of those who drink liquor. It's only true of people like me. Alcoholics. There are a few things about the physical part of the disease that I must forever keep in the top of my mind. Right up in the very top of my consciousness. Number one, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And I gotta stop a minute. 2 weeks ago, right now, Mr. C and I were in Canada. We went up on a Thursday to a conference. And on Wednesday before we left, I talked in Pasadena. And the first man that I ever talked to in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that over the phone to find a place that I could go to a meeting. So this man was sober 21 years and 6 months ago. And he might have had a year at that time. I don't know. But this man, the first man that I ever talked to, was at his first meeting Wednesday night. He was back after probably 4 or 5 years in the jungle. After 18 straight years of total abstinence, he went out into the jungle again. And he was attending his first meeting the night I talked to him. This is the thing that makes it so necessary for me to keep these things up here. But by the grace of God, that's me. So, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Secondly, the physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time, even during long extended periods of total abstinence. Now, this kills more alcoholics than any other one thing but resentment. It's so easy for an alky, when they get a little distance between themselves and the bottle, to let that old subconscious thing start working. I'm building me up some good drinking time. You know? I'm building me up some good drinking time. There's no such thing as an alky building up good drinking time. I am 21 years worse off, so far as successfully drinking liquor is concerned, than I was when I got here. And I was not in robust health when I came. And I know it, and I don't have to take a drink to prove it, because I have been close to and active in this program for 21 years and 6 months. And just as an aside, because this don't mean anything, but I reckon that I have attended between 4 and 5 meetings a week for 21 years and 6 months. And I haven't attended one since I woke up to the fact that I was sober, because I was afraid I was going to get drunk. I've attended every one of them for the same reasons I'm here, because I love this program and I love its people. And I'm comfortable here. More comfortable than many places else in the world. The physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time, even during long extended periods of total absence. And lastly, there's no cure for the body. We had all the money in Texas. I just thought, would that be one of them? It wouldn't be enough to send me someplace to get my body made over so I could successfully drink. There is no cure for the body. So what are we going to do about it? Nothing. I have no more good drinking time left, period. I never will have any more good drinking time left, period. And so we accept that fact and turn to the other half of the disease. the obsessions of the mind that cause us to drink. You see, if I, being an alcoholic, want to get rid of that bottle, I've got to be rid of its cause. When the body is totally dry, there is no physical demand for liquor. The physical takes over after the first slug. The first slug is mental. And if I'm going to get rid of the bottle, I've got to be rid of the mental obsessions that caused me to drink. And this takes some doing. This takes some doing. And our book tells us very plainly that it not only takes a little doing on our part, but it takes a little help from power greater than ourselves. The book says that under certain conditions, certain circumstances, it seems that there's only one defense against that first slug. Only one. And that's help from a power greater than ourselves. The book says lack of power was my dilemma. Power dilemma. And it was obvious if we lacked the power, we had to find one. And it was just as obvious that it must be a power greater than ourselves. This I believe as I believe I'm standing here. And for just a simple reason. If I could have remained sober, I would not believe that. I could not remain sober, therefore I believe it. It's a good thing for a monkey like me that there is a power that's available to me when I fulfill the conditions, or I would have been dead 21 years ago. So I believe it. Now, how are we going to get this help from far greater than yourself? We got a formula that's absolutely foolproof. Absolutely foolproof. And all we got to do is fulfill the conditions of the formula. There it is. What are the conditions? Number one, that we accept ourselves as we are where we are. I'd like to tell you a little story right here. Eve's got to catch a plane, so she's going to leave directly, but otherwise you can stay. You're not catching a plane. I hope. To accept ourselves exactly as we are where we are. About a dozen years ago, I was in Odessa. And we had a little meeting that was unscheduled at 7 o'clock on Sunday morning. It was at this very function, the state conference. I had been scheduled to talk on Sunday, and I had to get home for Monday. And you can't get out of Odessa at 10 o'clock in the morning. So I had traded with the late Bill Mundy. God rest his soul. I loved that man. And I talked Friday night, and as soon as I got through talking, they said, well, there are people coming Saturday that want to hear you. Will you talk again? And I said, if you can clear it with the committee, I will, because I'm here and I don't care. And so they set this thing up for 7 o'clock Sunday morning, and I thought there'd be 24. And I went down there at 7 o'clock Sunday morning, and everybody was there. Maybe some of you were there. And it was one of those meetings where there was nothing but love. Because everybody that was there because he wanted to be. And we had a wonderful time together. And after the meeting, a lady came up. And she may be in this audience, I don't know. And she was obviously born to the purple. She was in mink and diamonds, and she belonged to them, and they belonged to her. And she was crying her eyes out. And she says, Chuck, you will never know what's happened to me this morning. She says, I have been in this society for 14 years and a half, and I haven't had a drink. But I have never been able to accept myself as an alcoholic. She says, I have fought this for 14 years and a half. And I'm free. I'm free. Now, this is what we're talking about. To accept ourselves as we are where we are. Our book puts it like this. It says we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. What a day it is when we can and do accept ourselves exactly as we are where we are. Because then we're in position to get a little help. But until then, nobody can help us, not even God. The second condition is that sobriety become first. Sobriety for sobriety's sake. Sobriety for sobriety's sake. With no conditions on it at all. None. Sobriety must come first, top man on the totem pole. And our book puts it like this. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Any length means top. Why? Because we got to get some help from a power greater than ourselves, and we got to get the hell out of our own way before we can get it. And there are things we got to do. And there are things we won't do unless it's first. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And then it says, here are the steps we took. Here are the steps we took, T-double-O-K took. Now, isn't it funny? We Aussies with these keen alcoholic minds of ours can't read that line. That little bitty old line, we can't read it. There's not a word in it more than five letters. And we can't read it. Here are the steps we took. One of the greatest lines in the book. There are two lines in this book that to me are absolutely fabulous. This is one of them. Here are the steps we took. And the other one is, we cease to fight anything or anybody. Oh, what a deal this is. We cease to fight anything or anybody. Nothing to prove. Not going any place. You know? This crazy Julian says he can make a living by accident. He said he was trying to get ahead that was killing him. Isn't that terrific? We cease to fight anything or anybody. What a deal. Now, it's very, very significant. It don't say, here are the steps we read. Here are the steps we heard read. Here are the steps we learned by heart. Here are the steps we discussed in last night's discussion meeting. Now, all these things are good, but they're not good enough. It don't say, here are the steps we interpreted. If you want to stay drunk a while longer, start interpreting the steps. You nip and interpret and interpret and nip and nip and interpret. And then you nip and don't interpret. Here are the steps we took. T-double-O-K. And then it lists 12 steps. 12 steps. Now, why in the world do we tell new people that they don't need to take these steps too fast? If there's any of them they don't like, to skip them. It says in the first 30-12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, meaning the first 11. How are we going to have a spiritual awakening as the result of 11 steps we took? It's that simple. You know, again and again and again, if we're going to get the help from this power greater than ourselves, we've got to clear away the wreckage of the past. We've got to wash some windows. We've got to roll away the stones. And that's what the first 9 steps in this program does for us. And it don't do it unless we take them. To apply these first 9 steps to our very own self. Put us in condition to get the help. And if we don't take them, we don't get it. I've got to tell this little thing and then we'll hurry on. A year ago, in the middle of May, Mrs. T and I were at Niagara Falls, Canada, the Blossom Festival. And the first man that talked on Friday night was a great big good-looking guy. He looked good-looking and he looked good. And he said, you people that have known me for some time will remember that I had an open sore on my forehead. Says it was a little bigger than a silver dollar. And it wouldn't heal. And it was diagnosed as cancer. And they recommended 5 treatments of a certain kind per week, for 5 weeks. Now he says, do you think I took 1 treatment a week for 5 weeks? Do you think I took 5 treatments a week for 1 week? No. He says, I took 5 treatments a week for 5 weeks. And you see it's gone? Now he says, why do we think we can chip you around with these steps? That was nothing but a lousy skin cancer. And here we are messing with a terminal disease. Life and death. Ah, this is the way we come into this way of life. Is by applying these steps to our very own selves. To the best of our ability one day at a time. We hear a lot about two-stepping in this program. There's no such thing as a two-stepper in Alcoholics Anonymous. It isn't even one step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and ran to carry the message. Ha ha. That's a half and a third. That isn't 2 steps. And if I read my book right, it says back there under someplace, it's obvious that we can't transmit something we don't have. We got to have a message before we can carry it. You know? You can't give away something you ain't got. Now, don't get me wrong. From the very minute one of us admits that we're powerless over alcohol and that our lives have become unmanageable and come to an AA meeting and see and feel this thing, from that minute on, we are capable of carrying the drunk to the message, but not of carrying the message to the drunk. We can go to our friends and say, look, There are a bunch of people down here that are nuts. They're alkies and they don't drink. And I think they got some. How about going with me to a meeting? We can do that. We can carry the drunks to the message, but we gotta have a message before we can carry the message to the drunks. No such thing as a two-stepper. We hear so many times, I tried Alcoholics Anonymous and it didn't work for me. How often do you hear that in working with people? Of course Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work for them. Alcoholics Anonymous has never worked for anybody, and it never will. It never will. Alcoholics Anonymous is a way to do something. It is the most effective way for a drunk to find himself that has ever been conceived in the mind of man through the grace of God. But it's a formula for sobriety. It's not, it don't do anything. Formulas don't do anything. Recipes don't bake cakes. There's not a lady in this room this morning that expects their recipe for devil's food cake to build them a good devil's food cake while they're in this meeting. Not one of them's going home thinking they got a cake baked by the recipe. That's a way to build a cake. And it is a way to get sober and remain sober. So AA don't fail anybody. We fail. Now, I want to close by talking a little about esteem, love, and service. I told you that I attended probably between 4 and 5 meetings a week for 21 years and 6 months. I've got 7,860 days, something like that, that I wouldn't have had if it hadn't been for this program, Bob. And I'm very, very grateful. And I think often of how I might show my gratitude, because this program, of course, would not be possible but by, for, or with the grace of God. Because there's no answer to this thing called life. The thing you and I, as alcoholics, have had to have since the day we were born. There's no answer to this thing called life. For the alcoholic or the non-alcoholic, that does not include a personally satisfactory, conscious partnership with God, our very own God, and the entire business of living. There's no answer to it other than this. And so I think to myself, how can I show my gratitude? Should I go up on the side of the mountain and dig a hole and crawl in it and pray for the rest of my life? I don't think so. Should I become a hermit or a monk or something? I don't think so. The only way I know to serve God is to serve His kids. I don't know any other way to serve God but to serve His kids. And probably one of the greatest things that our program gives us, besides the ability to live one day at a time without drinking, is a permanent program for living. A lifetime program for living. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles all of our faith for the rest of our days. A lifetime program of living we've got. And that's the only way I know to express my gratitude, is to try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all my affairs. There's a little thing about attraction, you know, in the Levitt tradition. And this doesn't just mean attraction in an AA meeting. It means that you and I should so walk in all departments of our lives that people looking at us might say, I'd like to have whatever this guy's got, this gal. Now, this is in all departments of life, not just in an AA meeting, because this is attraction, you see, rather than promotion. And so it's necessary that we practice these principles in all of our affairs. All of our affairs, at home, at play, at work, in a whole business. It's not only necessary, but it's fulfillment to the ultimate when we do it. Now, how long has it been since I saw a drunk? How long? 12, 15 years? I've never seen a drunk in 12, 15 years. And yet my plant is 40th and Alameda in Los Angeles. And every time I go downtown, if I have time, I go to the head of 5th Street and drive west. Because 5th Street's our skid row. And it draws me like a magnet. And nearly every time I go down there, not long after I turn in or just before I turn into 5th Street, the Black Mariah's there. Now I know that Black Mariah inside out. I've ridden in her in chains. And here she comes. Well, the inhabitants of Skid Row, they know that Black Mariah too. And they know the rag pickers are sitting right there, you know, looking for them. And here's this little old wino, and he's got a bottle of muscadoodle. And he's got it in a brown paper bag so nobody will know what he's got. And he sees her coming too. And he tries to make it to the alley. And he goes down about 6 times. But do you think he busts that bottle? No. He busts his hind end, but he don't bust that bottle. And he makes it to the alley. And I say, thank God, thank God. Because you see, that's me. That's me, but with the grace of God. That's me. And I drive on down the street, and here sits the old boy in the doorway. And it's July, and he's got his black overcoat on. And he's got his bottle sitting right there with him. And he's sitting there laughing and talking with his friends. And they're not there. And I can't hardly drive by. I want to leave that car sitting right in the middle of 5th Street and go over and pick him up and put him on my lap. And say, look, brother, there's a better way. Because you see, that's me. But with the grace of God. I used to wear my overcoat in July. I used to meet the people and talk with them, and they talked with me. And they weren't there. I think one of the toughest things my family ever had to put up with is so often we'd be in the same living room, and I'd have company, and they wouldn't have any. So you see, that's me, but with the grace of God. Now this thing extends throughout life with me. I don't know any ex-cons. I don't know any ex-inhabitants of the mental hospitals of the country. I don't know any ex-anything. Ah, why can't we get rid of the necessity to categorize each other and stifle life? I don't know any ex-anything. I know God's kids with problems, and a few of God's kids with answers. And so we share... First, with the alcoholic, but then with anybody that wants, out here or not, we share in love. Now, what is this thing called love? You know, I thought I was an expert in this thing called love. Hell, I could preach you the most beautiful sermon 35 years ago on this that you ever heard. If two or three men and a boy would hold me up long enough to do it. But I never knew anything about love. I never knew love until I came to my first meeting. And I never had a sponsor. I came to my first meeting as alone as any man ever walked. Mrs. C was divorced me after 20 years. Kids wouldn't come home when I was around if they could help it. My boss had sent word to the plant if I ever stepped foot in the plant again, or to the house. If I ever stepped foot in the plant again, he's going to throw me through the window. And the window to which he referred does not open. And he came in to do it too, but he didn't because something happened. I had no health, no sanity, no home, no job, and no money. And I came here not looking for answers to those questions. Not with a great desire to get my wife back. She was gone and should be gone. She should have divorced me 10 years before, and I knew it. And I knew why the kids wouldn't speak to me, wouldn't come home when I was around. It wasn't their fault, it was mine. I wasn't entitled to have these things. And I came here looking for one thing. Hoping against hope, I might find a way to live that didn't include the bottle. And I would have settled for the meanest old unhappy sobriety on the face of the earth, just so I didn't have to drink. And I walked up and looked at this little group of people. You remember this is over 21 years ago? And there were just a few. It was on the ground floor. And it struck me that I'd come the wrong night, because this was the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall, and there were 30, 35 people there, and they didn't look like me. They weren't dressed like me. They certainly weren't talking like me, because they were all yakking, and it was all happy talk. And I stood there looking at him, and I thought, oh God, they've given me the wrong night. These are the veterans and their wives, and they're here for a party. Because it was the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall. And I said to myself, I'll have to leave and come back tonight to Drunk Street. And I turned to go. And I was dead when I got there. But I was double dead when I turned to leave. Here at long last I'd come, and it was the wrong night. And I turned in complete desolation. And somebody inside had been looking at me, and he come scurrying over the door. And he called to me, "Mister, were you looking for somebody?" And I said, "No, sir." And he says, "Well, what were you looking for?" And I, thinking he was a veteran, said, "Well, if it would interest you, sir, I was looking for sobriety." And there was an immediate transformation. The guy lit up like a Christmas tree. Everything about him changed. He just lit up. And I was hooked before he ever opened his mouth again. And when he did, he says, "Well, take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place." Now, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. Without this, no recovery. Without this, no recovery. You see, here was a man that was glad I was there. Glad, clear through, that I was there. I'd never seen him before in my life. The people that knew me wouldn't even speak to me. And here was a stranger that was glad. And he says, "Why, take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place." And he leads me in and shares with me. And literally rocked me to sleep. And I learned about love from drunks. And you see, God is love. God is love. And God is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And God is life. And you and I are life. And this is what we discover. You see, God has always known we were his kids. But you and I personally have to discover this for ourselves. And that's the reason I can stand here and tell you that I thank God for hell. I didn't spend 5 seconds in hell that weren't necessary. Because for the likes of me, it's the only way I could have gotten here. I had to burn up. And now what's happened? What can we look forward to? What is the great message? It's this. I haven't had to have a drink or a pill for 7,860 days. And that's so good. For a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk, that's terrific. It's enough to thank God for with every breath I draw for the rest of my life. What else? I got a new body out of the thing. Most of you wouldn't have given very much for it yesterday, but today it's pretty good. You see, it took me 3.5 years to get over falling on my face after my last drunk. That's the kind of a body I brought. But I haven't fallen on my face for 18 years. And that's good. There's nothing wrong with that. What else? My family was put back together. Same wife. Same kid. But what a difference. 20 years of the most beautiful life you can imagine. With the same wife and the same kid. And if we live to the 24th of this month, we'll have 42 years in double harness. And that's indecent in Hollywood, you know. Well, now, that's pretty good. But what else? Well, I own the business they threw me out of. Now, this is impossible. This is something I never even dreamed of whilst drunk. And I had some king-sized dreams. Like saving the Pope in an earthquake. You don't know how wild that is because I'm not even a Catholic, you know. But I never dreamed of owning that business, but I do. What else? Something that's infinitely better than all those things. I got a God of my very own. My very own. And wherever I am, he is. And I'm never alone anymore. I share everything in life with you. The good, the bad, and the indifferent. We have a lot of fun together. And I'm not afraid of him. And I don't think he's afraid of me. We share everything. You know, it's not normal to walk alone. I was out yonder for 43 years. Cold outside. It's normal for us to walk down the high road of life even as we do now, with our arms around each other, sharing our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. This is normal. And this is AA. And it's not normal to be away from the Father's house. It's normal to become as little children. Totally dependent on this great thing called God. And how fortunate are you and I? Because, you see, we weren't even looking for God. We were looking for sobriety. And the conditions for sobriety, and the conditions of the good life, and the conditions of God are all the same. Same thing. And so we come up sober. And we come up at peace. And we come up with God. And how joyous it is to walk with him. As we walk with each other. And say one to another in meetings like this as we always do. Did not our hearts burn within us as he walked with us and talked with us? By the way, sir, God bless you. Thank you very much.
Remain standing, please. Will you just remain standing, please? Chuck, here is a gift from the San Antonio Alcoholics Anonymous in grateful appreciation of your sharing with us the 22nd Texas State AA Convention. God bless you. If you remain standing, we'll ask Bob Fay to dismiss us, please.